Imagine, for just a second, that it's a Tuesday evening. You've just finished checking the local news, you know, to see if the municipal guidelines for building a nuclear fallout shelter in your backyard have been updated.
Right, with the blueprints literally sitting right there on the kitchen table.
Exactly. And then, just to unwind from all that, you walk into the living room, you click on the television set, and you watch a brand new cartoon about a family flying around in a futuristic high-tech car, totally carefree.
It sounds, I mean, almost like science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Or like a really heavy-handed satire.
Yeah.
But that cognitive dissonance, that bizarre blend of apocalyptic dread and shiny manufactured optimism that was just the daily reality of living in the year 1962.
Welcome to our latest deep dive. We are doing something, well, a little different today. We aren't looking at a single person or like a specific scientific breakthrough.
No, we're taking on a whole year.
Yeah, we have a massive stack of notes pulled from this incredible historical retrospective by Megan Pays from the History of Rock and Roll blog. And our mission today is to completely immerse ourselves in one single trip around the sun, 1962.
Which is actually a really fascinating challenge. Usually, you know, when we look at history, we isolate threads.
Right.
We study the civil rights movement, or we study the space race, or the evolution of pop music. But Megan's blog really forces us to look at them cross-sectionally.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because I want to give you, the listener, a framework for how we're going to approach this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
As I was going through the source material, this specific image just kept coming to mind. 1962 wasn't just a year on a calendar. It was a cultural pressure cooker.
A pressure cooker. I like that.
Yeah. I was genuinely amazed to see how many of the foundational pillars of our modern everyday lives were forged in these exact 12 months.
The pressure cooker analogy is really apt, actually. Because a pressure cooker doesn't just hold ingredients, you know. The enclosed tension fundamentally changes their chemistry.
Right. It cooks them faster.
Exactly. Under President John F. Kennedy, the atmosphere of 1962 was defined by extreme, almost unbearable polarities. The most obvious one, of course, being the Cold War.
Right. And we have to be careful here, I think, not to view the Cold War through the, like, sanitized lens of a history book. The source material heavily emphasizes the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Because it wasn't just abstract political posturing. The standoff between the U.S. and the Soviets over those nuclear missiles in Cuba is widely considered the closest humanity has ever intentionally come to total catastrophic nuclear annihilation.
I mean, try to put yourself in the shoes of someone walking down the street that October.
Yeah.
You aren't just worried about the economy or your job. You are carrying this pervasive, tangible fear that the world might literally end before the weekend.
It's heavy.
It is. That has to do something to the collective human psyche.
It pushes people to the absolute edge. But, well, what's fascinating here is how that existential terror interacted with human ambition.
How so?
Because the pressure of the Cold War actually accelerated progress in other areas. It became this geopolitical mandate to prove ideological superiority, right? Which gives us the triumphs of the space race.
Oh, wow. Right.
1962 is the year the Mercury program achieves its massive milestone. John Glenn becomes the first American to orbit the Earth.
So we are literally touching the stars. Humanity is achieving orbit, looking down at this unified, borderless blue marble.
Exactly.
But I do have to push back on this idea of progress just a bit. Because when you look at the rest of the source material for this year, it feels like we were still in the dark ages down on the ground.
You're referring to the domestic struggles highlighted in the blog, I assume.
I am, yeah. The same country that has the technological mastery to calculate orbital mechanics and safely return a human being from the cosmos is, at the very same time, tearing itself apart over basic human rights.
It's a striking contrast.
In 1962, James Meredith becomes the first African-American student to enroll at the University of Mississippi.
And the mechanism of that enrollment is really crucial to understand. Based on the source, it wasn't a peaceful integration.
Not at all.
It was met with such violent systemic opposition that it required the direct intervention of federal marshals and military troops just to allow a citizen to attend a university.
It is just a wild contradiction to process, you know. We are slipping the surly bonds of Earth, yet fighting tooth and nail over who is allowed to sit in a classroom.
Yeah.
And if that cognitive dissonance wasn't enough, the source material points out that 1962 is also the year Rachel Carson publishes Silent Spring,
which effectively birthed the modern environmentalist movement.
Make that make sense for me, though. Why did a book about pesticides trigger an entire movement in this specific year?
Well, because prior to Silent Spring, The post-World War II narrative was basically better living through chemistry.
Right, the whole miracle of modern science thing.
Exactly. Humanity felt it had conquered nature. We were spraying DDT indiscriminately, believing our scientific advancements were infallible.
Just totally safe.
Yeah, but Carson's book made the invisible consequences visible. She meticulously explained the mechanism of how toxins move up the food chain, ultimately poisoning the birds, hence the silent spring, and potentially humans too.
Wow.
It was a complete paradigm shift. It forced a society that was arrogantly aiming for the moon to realize they were quietly poisoning the soil beneath their own feet.
It all comes back to that pressure cooker. You have the threat of nuclear war, the violent struggle for civil rights, and the sudden realization that our own technology might be killing our ecosystem.
Yeah.
But human beings can't live at a level 10 panic indefinitely, right? The psyche just breaks.
It demands a release valve.
Exactly. Wait, I shouldn't say exactly, because I'm actually really curious how that release valve manifests on a mass scale.
Okay.
Because the blog pivots from these heavy existential crises to things that seem almost, well, trivial. It talks about commerce and art.
It's not trivial at all, actually. It's the architecture of modern escapism.
Escapism.
Yeah. When the front page of the newspaper is terrifying, people retreat. They seek comfort, control, and distraction. And 1962 provided the blueprint for how we still distract ourselves today.
Okay.
For instance, the source notes, this is the year the very first Walmart opens its doors.
Okay, a discount store opening. How does that tie into coping with Cold War anxiety?
Think about the mechanism of consumerism. In an era where you have zero control over whether a superpower launches a missile, you do have control over your purchasing power.
Oh, I see.
Sam Walton realized that massive centralized access to affordable manufactured goods wasn't just a convenience, it was a psychological comfort. It democratized the American dream.
So anyone could walk in and buy a piece of the post-war bounty?
Right.
Buying stuff as a coping mechanism? I mean, it clearly caught on. But the blog also brings up Andy Warhol introducing pop art to the mainstream with his iconic Campbell soup cans.
Yes, a huge moment.
I have to be honest, I struggle with this one a bit. Are we really saying a painting of a soup can was a profound reaction to the era? Or was it just provocative for the sake of it?
Oh, it's deeply connected. Before Warhol, the art world was dominated by abstract expressionism.
Like Jackson Pollock, that kind of thing?
Exactly. Very serious, emotional, complex art. Warhol looked at American society in 1962 and realized that the true shared culture wasn't high art at all. It was mass production.
Mm.
By painting a Campbell's soup can, he was elevating the most mundane, reliable, mass-produced item you could find in that brand new Walmart and calling it art.
Wow.
It was a rejection of serious, heavy existentialism. It was safe, familiar, and strangely comforting.
I see what you're saying. If the profound things like the fate of humanity are too terrifying to contemplate, you elevate the superficial things instead.
Exactly.
That actually explains the sports and entertainment landscape of 1962 perfectly. The blog mentions Wilt Chamberlain scoring 100 points in a single NBA game.
A record that remains unbroken, by the way.
Right. It feels less like a sports statistic and more like modern mythology. We needed superhuman heroes because our own human fragility was so glaringly obvious.
Absolutely.
And if you couldn't find a hero on the basketball court, you just looked at the television in your living room. Jackie Kennedy took television viewers on a historic televised tour of a White House that year.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that White House tour was a revolutionary use of media.
In what way?
Well, television was still a relatively young medium. By bringing the cameras inside, Jackie Kennedy forged a parasocial relationship with the American public.
Right, making them feel like they actually knew her.
She brought elegance, youth, and a sense of calm sophistication directly into millions of living rooms. It made the presidency feel accessible and stable during a time of immense instability.
And the programming surrounding that tour was just exploding. The source material lists a lineup that basically laid the foundation for the next 50 years of television.
It really did.
You have the debut of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson.
Establishing the late night talk show format as the ultimate national bedtime routine.
Yeah. You also have The Lucy Show, The War Drama Combat, and McHale's Navy. But the two that really stick out to me in the context of what we're discussing are the Beverly Hillbillies and the Jetsons.
Ah, yes. They represent the two distinct directions of escapism, nostalgic retreat and optimistic projection.
Let's look at the Beverly Hillbillies first. You have a society grappling with space travel and nuclear physics, and the biggest hit on television is about a family from the rural mountains moving to a mansion in California.
Right.
It's a total rejection of modernity. It's comforting because the characters are completely unbothered by the complexities of the modern world.
And then you have the Jetsons, which functions as the exact opposite, yet serves the exact same purpose.
Right, because it was an antidote to nuclear dread.
It promised the public that not only would humanity survive the Cold War, but the future was going to be fantastic.
We wouldn't be living in irradiated bunkers.
No, we'd have robot maids, flying cars, and conveyor belt living.
It's fascinating how media creates these alternate realities for us to inhabit. And it wasn't just television either.
Oh, definitely not.
The blog points out that 1962 gave us monumental, sweeping cinema. Films like To Kill a Mockingbird, the massive visual spectacle of Lawrence of Arabia, and the pure joy of The Music Man.
All in one year.
Yeah. You put all of this together, the birth of Walmart, Warhol's pop art, late night talk show, the sitcoms, the epics, and it really does look like the infrastructure of modern distraction being built all at once.
It was a necessary ballast. You know, the culture was figuring out how to compartmentalize.
Mm-hmm.
But while television and cinema were busy offering comfort and distraction, the music industry was doing something entirely different.
Right. The music section of this blog is huge.
The music of 1962 wasn't just offering an escape. It was acting as a chaotic, real-time mirror of a society in heavy transition.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the blog dives into the Billboard charts of 1962, and it is a wild collision of genres.
Chaotic is the best word for it.
We're well past the initial shock of the 1950s rock and roll explosion. Now the boundaries are completely blurring. The source material highlights Ray Charles taking this incredibly bold step.
Yes, releasing modern sounds in country and Western music.
Explain why that was such a seismic shift. Because to a modern ear, an artist crossing genres is pretty standard. Why was it such a massive deal in 1962?
Well, you have to look at the structural barriers of the time. Country music and rhythm and blues were heavily segregated, not just socially, but in the actual mechanics of the music industry.
Like completely separate ecosystems.
Exactly. Different radio stations, different record labels, different retail placement in stores. And this is the height of the civil rights movement, where racial tensions are dominating the news.
Right.
Then you have Ray Charles, a black, blind R&B pioneer, taking the traditional white rural sounds of country music and infusing them with his own soul and arrangements.
And the public bought it.
They bought it in droves. It was a massive commercial success. It proves that musical resonance wasn't bound by these rigid, racially defined market categories.
That's amazing.
It was a profound statement of universal artistic value delivered right in the middle of a deeply divided country.
Pure artistic bravery. But what's so striking about 1962 is that Ray Charles's groundbreaking album was sharing the charts with such a bizarre variety of other sounds.
Yeah, the old guard was still very much there.
You still had the architects of the 1950s holding massive sway. Elvis Presley was still dominating. Tony Bennett releases the absolute standard, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, providing that classic, polished crooner sound.
Yet simultaneously, the youth culture is driving these highly manufactured, ephemeral dance crazes.
Oh yeah, the blog lists Little Eva dropping the Locomotion and Bruce Channel's hit Hey Baby.
And we really can't talk about youth culture in 1962 without talking about the Beach Boys.
No, absolutely not. The blog specifically notes them introducing surfing music to the national consciousness.
Which goes right back to our discussion on escapism.
Right.
The Beach Boys were packaging a very specific, idealized myth of the sunny, carefree California lifestyle.
Just surfing in cars.
Right. It was tight, complex vocal harmonies masking incredibly simple, innocent subject matter. If you were a teenager in the Midwest, terrified of the draft or the evening news, a 2-minute song about catching a wave was the ultimate psychological vacation.
I'm looking at the sheer volume of artists listed in this retrospective, and it's staggering. The Four Seasons, Neil Sedaka, The Drifters, Brian Hyland, Booker T, and the MGs, The Crystals, Shelley Fabares, Dion.
It's a lot.
It reads like a shotgun blast of different sounds. Pop, R&B, instrumental soul, doo-wop. The industry is throwing everything at the wall.
Because the tectonic plates of culture were shifting, and the music industry was desperately trying to find its footing.
Right.
And underneath the polished pop and the dance crazes, the real revolution was quietly gathering momentum. 1962 sees the folk music scene begin to transition from niche coffee houses to serious mainstream influence.
The source material points to Peter, Paul, and Mary acting as that bridge, bringing folk to a wider audience.
And the mechanism there is really important. Folk music wasn't about escapism. It was about confrontation.
Oh, that's a good distinction.
It was music as social utility, used to directly address civil rights, labor movements, and anti-war sentiments. It was acoustic, raw, and entirely focused on the message.
Which perfectly sets the stage for a young guy named Bob Dylan, who, according to the blog, begins his legendary recording sessions at Columbia Records in 1962.
A huge turning point.
We also have the incredibly emotive, sweeping vocals of Roy Orbison and Sam Cooke, completely reshaping the emotional depth of pop music.
But perhaps the most fascinating detail hiding in the timeline of 1962, the one that really signals the end of one era and the beginning of another, happens mostly under the radar.
You're talking about the British invasion.
Yes. The blog notes that an instrumental track by the Tornadoes became the first English group to hit number one in the U.S. And far more importantly, quietly across the ocean in the U.K., a band called the Beatles releases their very first single, Love Me Do.
It honestly gives me chills just thinking about the timing. When you look at all this musical data combined, 1962 isn't just a year, it's a changing of the guard.
It really is.
It's the exact moment where the titans of the fading 50s, Elvis, Tony Bennett, are passing the baton to the architects of the 1960s, Bob Dylan, the Beach Boys, and the Beatles. They are all literally sharing the same radio waves for a few fleeting months.
It requires you to, like, imagine the experience of turning the dial on an AM radio that summer.
Yeah.
You might hear the polished orchestral swell of a crooner, followed instantly by the raw acoustic strumming of a folk protest song.
All right.
Followed by an R&B legend singing a country standard, and finished off by a brand new, reverb-heavy surf anthem. The airwaves were vibrating with the exact same unpredictable, volatile, and ultimately progressive energy that was tearing through global politics and domestic civil rights.
So what does this all mean? We started out by asking you to think of 1962 as a cultural pressure cooker. And after pulling apart Megan Pace's retrospective, I don't think there's a better way to describe it.
I completely agree.
We looked at a window of 12 months where humanity managed to hurl itself into orbit while simultaneously staring down the barrel of total nuclear annihilation.
Yeah, we saw federal troops deployed just to enforce the basic civil right of a man attending college, while Rachel Carson fundamentally rewired how we view our dominance over nature.
And we examined the mechanisms of how society coped with that immense weight.
Exactly.
We watched the architecture of modern distraction being built from the ground up, the democratization of consumerism with Walmart, the elevation of mass production in Warhol's pop art, and the invention of the parasocial political relationship via Jackie Kennedy's TV tour.
Right. We saw how television offered us a way to hide in the rural nostalgia of the Beverly Hillbillies, or project our hopes onto the flying cars of the Jetsons.
All while the music industry acted as a perfect real-time mirror of a culture desperately trying to figure out what it wanted to become next.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. Yeah. I look at a year like 1962, and honestly, I find it deeply reassuring. Because when the world today feels overwhelmingly chaotic, fast-paced, and divided, it is easy to think we are living in unprecedented times.
I at least think that.
Yeah, but we've navigated these massive, chaotic, transitional periods before. The extreme tension of 1962 didn't break society. It forged new tools, new art, new methods of coping, and forced a necessary evolution in human rights.
This raises an important question, though, and it's a thought I want to leave you with.
Okay.
If we can look back at the intense pressures of 1962, and so clearly trace the mechanisms that planted the seeds for the next 60 years of our media, our environmental awareness, and our music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is happening right now?
Oh, that's a wild thought.
Look at the chaotic, disconnected events of our current year, which seemingly minor technological shift or obscure artist or overlooked piece of legislation is secretly writing the history books for the year 2086. What is today's Silent Spring or today's Love Me Do?
Man, that is the kind of question that forces you to look at the daily news in a completely different way. I love it.
It changes your perspective entirely.
It really does. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the pressure cooker of 1962. Keep questioning the things around you. Keep looking for the invisible wires connecting the events of our world, and we will catch you on the next one.